wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm John Nelson. Today, Bill Resnick speaks with Kenzo Esquivel about the largest strike in the history of American higher education, happening right now in California. Fran Michelle reviews the novel Confessions of the Fox by Jordy Rosenberg, and Desiree Halligers brings us part two on the life and legacy of Yvonne Simmons. First up, 48,000 researchers, teaching assistants, and grad student teachers are currently on strike across the University of California system. Bill Resnick talks to one of its leaders on the Berkeley campus. Here's Bill Resnick speaking with Kenzo Esquivel for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Hi, Kenzo Esquivel. Welcome to KBU Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Kenzo Esquivel is a graduate student and research assistant in agroecology and sustainable agriculture. Tell us just a little bit about your various roles at the university and your work.
So my name is Kenzo Esquivel. I'm a fourth-year PhD candidate in the Department of Environmental Science, Policy, and Management at UC Berkeley, and I'm also an elected head steward of our Union of Graduate Student Instructors, Readers, and Tutors, UAW 2865. In my academic capacities, I'm currently serving as a graduate research fellow working on my dissertation research, which tries to understand both the socio-political and economic constraints that farmers face in adopting sustainable management practices, and then how those practices impact soil health and agricultural production. So currently, I'm a researcher moving forward on my dissertation work, but in the past, I've also been a teaching assistant and taught classes. I've TA'd classes and will TA classes again in the future.
You're local, 2865, in which you're a leader, but the union, it seems to me, is like the Wobblies, who always told the arresting police, we are all leaders. I think that's what you're trying to develop. The local is one of three United Auto Workers locals that has a total of 48,000 members. They're grad student teachers, researchers, teaching assistants, tutors, and other important roles in the University of California system. And they are now all on strike together with the joint bargaining team. It's the largest strike in the history of American higher ed, and what happens at the University of California will set the standard for over 2 million, mostly young people, who do this work in universities across the country. Further, a successful strike at UC will surely strengthen today all the worker rebellions of the young, especially, of course, highly educated workers doing three jobs to get by, like at Amazon, Starbucks, groceries, so many others. Kenzo, tell us about the strike at the whole University of California system. Why are you 48,000 young people mostly striking?
Yeah, there are four different bargaining units that came together for this, represented by three different locals. There are the academic student employees, so that encompasses the graduate student instructors or TAs, teaching assistants, readers, and tutors. We have a newly formed union of student researchers called Student Researchers United, which will newly cover the graduate student who is doing kind of these research type appointments under a contract. And we also have UAW 5810, which represents postdoctoral scholars and academic staff researchers. And so what was really unique about this moment was our contract cycles lined up, and we really were talking to each other about our issues, our top line challenges that we were wanting to highlight in our contract campaigns, and realized that the struggles we faced were largely the same, which comes down to things like cost of living in California. All of our UC campuses tend to be in some of the most expensive places in the country, and our stipends across those different job titles were simply not enough to live in the places that we work and teach. So that was one very easy place to really find common cause to be negotiating and pushing on the university with united front to say that this is no longer tenable and there needs to be something that changes. And so wages were an obvious place, demanding that we can afford housing and not be rent burdened in the places that we live. There are other really important issues that have kind of come to the surface, including fighting for our international students and our student parents, part of the reason that I think we're really passionate about this campaign and moving it forward is that we're really fighting for the future of public higher education here. Like, we want our institutions of public higher education to be places that are accessible to all types of people, regardless of your generational access to wealth, depending on like your marital situation or whether you have kids. Like, anyone should be able to pursue an education at these places. So I think there's these core groups that we're fighting for in this contract campaign. And then also something that we really tried to get into this year, and again, this was a demand across all of our bargaining units, was to get the UC to actually commit to sustainable transit for workers to campus. We know that across the state, we are 48,000 workers, and some people are forced to live really far from campus to find affordable rents. And so we know that we're having a pretty significant carbon impact, and the UC has claimed that it wants to be a climate leader, and so we're forcing them to really put their money with their mouth is in giving us sustainable transit benefits, making sure that they're encouraging use of sustainable transit methods, public transportation, e-bikes, and then for those who do have to drive from further away, trying to get things like benefits for carpooling and other sustainable modes of transit to campus.
My understanding is that UC has become like the whole of U.S. industry. That is, they want to keep their pay to you as low as possible, and their money on other things like their salaries and big bonuses and salaries to superstar professors to keep them from going to NYU or Harvard or Yale, somebody with huge amounts of money, or lure some people that are at the University of Wisconsin or Michigan where they're on basically a lesser allowance, so they lure them. They also want you to be loyal to the job and like department stores and fast foods. My sense is they want you on call for emergencies or when needed for some other reasons having to do with the demands of the research or the demands of the students. And most of it, you are asked to be loyal to the research project, to went to work many more, it seems to me, than the 24 hours for which you're paid, which, of course, the students from low-income families who have to work three jobs just to pay for the gas for the car for coming from a long, long way. Anyway, they're very disadvantaged. How do you respond to the regents and administrators and their demands for loyalty and to work more than the 20 hours for which you're paid?
Yeah, I think that this has been one of the lines that we've been seeing in some reporting and definitely from the university is that technically speaking, we're paid for 20 hours of work a week. And that's how they justify these poverty wages. We're paid as graduate research assistants or TAs for 20 hours of work per week. But at the same time, we're also expected, if we're teaching, to be advancing on our research. And that research is really at the core of what the university does. And so between our research, our teaching duties, a lot of us do a ton of other service for the university, whether that's recruiting or talking to incoming graduate students, serving on panels, traveling to conferences to spread the research and impact of the university. Those are all part of the job, but because we're also students, they're kind of able to put those under our student hats, so then they don't feel like they have to pay us because we're learning, we're trainees still. And what we're trying to change is that it is completely unjustified to be able to only pay us for those 20 hours, and they need to pay us enough to live here. Bottom line, hard stop. And so I definitely think that it's right that we're asked to do a lot more than those 20 hours. And if there's any graduate student out there only doing 20 hours of work, I would love to know how you do it. But for the vast, vast majority of people, that is just absolutely not the case. And to your point about university loyalty and ensuring that folks are coming out and doing this work, I think a lot of our faculty will agree also. We had a Berkeley Faculty Association solidarity rally yesterday, and there was a professor who was like, I am overpaid. Like, I do not need as much money as the UC is giving me. And the UC's line on our budget proposals and our economic packages has been that they simply can't afford it. And we know that to be false. They have a multi-billion dollar budget, and they currently allocate maybe 1.5% of that to graduate student instructors, despite the fact that we are the ones meeting with students, leading their discussion sections. There are faculty who often lead large lecture classes, but the folks really doing the work of teaching and meeting students and making sure that they're understanding and developing as young scholars are graduate students. The research that happens often maybe is funded by a grant that a faculty member gets, But ultimately, the labor that goes into producing research is by and large conducted by graduate student researchers and by postdoctoral scholars and by academic researchers, these staff positions that we represent across our four units. And so it's pretty clear to us that we are the bulk of the labor that produces these two main products that the UC system prides itself on, research and teaching, yet they're unwilling to actually budget in how they allocate money to the various parts of the university, any sort of actual investment in that bulk workforce that does what it espouses to do. And so what we're really asking for here is a pretty significant shift, and we understand that. And we're just asking for the university to prioritize the workforce that makes the university run.
Kenzo, I used to be a scientist in genetics for a while. As an undergraduate, I was doing research. Anyway, I remember I was told research is 1% genius and 99% perseverance, that there's a huge amount of work, especially in scientific research, and just doing the experiments. And it's you folks who do all of that work. And because you do the work and you're close to it, you consult with these faculty people to, in fact, modify hypotheses, to find other avenues. I remember that in the genetics department. They were really dependent to people doing enormously interesting work in genetic statistics and stuff like that. They were completely dependent on their researchers to help them really refine their hypotheses and understandings, sometimes very greatly.
I think that's absolutely correct. In an ideal world, and I'm really lucky to have an incredibly supportive faculty member, but the process of going through graduate school is one of learning a lot, but also of becoming academic peers with our faculty. I think a lot of faculty members understand that the core of their research group and their contribution to scholarly work is through the labor of the graduate students and the postdocs that work in their groups. And this extends beyond the STEM fields too. Like, there are folks in humanities and social science divisions coming up with new understandings of how our world works, how our systems and societies work, who are creating independent and novel theories of how we understand the world around us, right? And they work with their faculty advisors on making sure that they are referencing the right texts and understand the base theory. But I think it really is the work of graduate students and postdocs who are really pushing forward all of our academic disciplines across fields. And I think there is a fundamental recognition that that is a huge part of what we do at the University of California. Is we are a big R1 institution, which means that we have high research output, and the people who are doing that output are connected to faculty insofar as we have our lab groups or you have a faculty advisor when you enter the university. But ultimately, the high volume of what's coming out is coming out from the postdocs, the academic researchers, and the graduate students. And so I think what you said hits the nail on the head. It's our work that moves this forward. And it's kind of, in a lot of ways, the first strike of its kind in thinking about bringing together all these different types of work that happen at university and striking under a united banner of creating a fair UC. And so that's been part of what's really exciting about this moment.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Kenzo Esquivel, a graduate student doing research in agriculture at UC Berkeley now. He's been teaching there as well, working with faculty, working with students, and he's also one of the union leaders. He's one of the head stewards in the United Auto Workers, UAW Local 2865. Many of them teaching, grading, doing all the consulting on research, getting government grants, but they earn $24,000 a year tops, which in Southern California is not enough to pay the rent, except maybe in hovels way out from the university. So many live out of a car. Many are from modest families and just drop out, actually. One of the many ways that people from well-to-do families manage to fight their way into elite work. So, Kenzo, in that situation, how did these 48,000 and more workers get organized? What's the secret to the success of your various locals?
It's been, in some ways, a multi-year campaign that has resulted in this. But really, if we scale out a little bit, it started in the 90s when we formed our original union, UAW 2865. And so it's been kind of this multi-generational, in terms of graduate student timelines, effort to really build up the strength of our union. And over the last, I would say, 3 to 5 years, there's really been a push to build membership, to create engagement in our union. And then really in the last few years, when we launched the Student Researchers Campaign, which actually came at the heels of working with our local legislators to change a law to ensure that graduate student researchers were able to unionize, gave us kind of the runway to really practice organizing from the bottom up, creating departmental structures of leadership, cultivating these organizing committees that brought in just everyday members of our union to really start to feel like they were plugged in, that they had a unified vision, and that when the time came, could mobilize their coworkers and their colleagues in their departments to strike and to understand the power of our strike. And so I would say that there's nothing new or novel in what we've done here. It's just been hard work organizing our coworkers, having conversations about kind of our conditions, really moving folks and understanding the fact that it's unacceptable for the University of California to continue to exploit its major workforce in the way that it has. And obviously that is premised on how academia has formed in this country since its inception, really, and getting graduate student workers, academic workers to really understand that we have a voice and we can change this institution, and our union is one of the strongest ways that we can really, really strongly change the structural forces that continue this type of exploitation of workers. And so it's really just those conversations, right? It's that peer-to-peer organizing, talking to folks in our departments, and when the time comes, making sure that we have the structures ready to get folks mobilized and out on the picket line and voting in that strike authorization vote. And it's been this gradual process also of becoming more in sync and in line with the postdocs union 5810. And it's been this gradual growing of our infrastructure to make sure that we could work in lockstep and to really win big in a way that has never been seen.
My sense is, knowing a few people in the union, I have the sense that the union does is what the Wobblies used to do, make everybody leaders, make everybody able to explain how they're exploited. You have to talk about class, it seems to me, how people are exploited and used, and then sometimes, often, in fact, most, discarded, actually.
Yeah, and I mean, that's at the core of it, right, is like to have those conversations. And it's really interesting with academic workers because we're really not conditioned or used to thinking about ourselves as workers in this way, right? A lot of folks in this academic space are the folks who were really good at school, who really are curious thinkers. But in the past, that's not really we necessarily thought of as who the rank and file of the labor movement are. And I think a lot of folks, especially at institutions like the UC, are conditioned to think that just being here is the goal and is good enough and that we don't deserve or need fair or adequate compensation. But what I've heard folks say is that prestige doesn't pay the bills and we are still humans and we are still folks who are struggling to live and really working through kind of that awareness of our graduate students and our academic workers, not just as students, but as workers, right? And building that identity and to get folks to see this bigger picture of like what we're trying to achieve here, what we're trying to win. And their role in that has been a huge part of how we've built this organization.
One additional thing is I have a sense that you folks finally developed the understandings, it's part of it, and when it's recognized, it becomes really an organizing principle of your life, in some ways a consolation, in some ways a motivating vision, that the world we're now living in is now unsustainable, but then in that great slogan, another world is necessary and possible. And talking about the sort of the human relations that would characterize that better world, I have the sense that that's part of the really successful unions because the people become committed do something larger than themselves or their income.
Totally. And I think that that's one of the things that, regardless of what happens in the next few weeks with their contract campaign, that gives me the most hope, actually, is that through this process, we've built a huge network of leaders that will go on to also lead their own labs and continue in the academic profession or outside, but who now have this analysis, this commitment, and this understanding of how they can continue to reshape academic society and structures and institutions outside of academia as well. And so I think that's one of the things that gives me hope, is that we are training just a huge cadre of folks who can go out and continue changing the status quo of academia and of other industries that academics go on to, and shifting how they think about the relation to labor and power and the agency that they can have in reshaping these institutions.
Kenzel, one last thing. How can Oregonians help in this?
Yeah, one of the really cool things has been to see how academics at other universities who either are or not yet unionized are getting inspired by this campaign. And so one thing I would say is, I don't know much about the universities up in Oregon, but if there comes a time that folks up there are starting to think about either unionizing or organizing around a big contract campaign, to just be up to date on that and engaged. In this moment, we do have a hardship fund set up, and so we do have this financial contribution that folks can plug into. And then I would say just amplifying the media that's coming out around this. I mean, a lot of it's pretty damning of the university and kind of how it's approached negotiations with us at the table. And so just continuing to really push this public eye on the university, because I think that their reputation is that they care profoundly about recruiting top students and students from inside and outside California, right? And so the more damage that we can do to its institutional reputation, the more pressure I think that they'll feel to come to the bargaining table in good faith. And so I would say that's the last thing, is just continuing to push and talk about our campaign with folks you know in your circles. I really appreciate you inviting me here to chat about it. And so thanks for having me.
Thank you, Kenzel Esquivel, 48,000 grad students, researchers, tutors, many others who do the work of the California system. Their strike, it's inspiring. Thanks for talking to us. We'll be right back.
Pablo on the Old Mole Variety Hour, the track titled Turn the Page, following Bill Resnick talking with Kenzo Esquivel. Up next, Desiree Hellegers continues her reflections on the remarkable life and legacy of Yvonne Simmons, international peace activist and a founding member of Portland Peace and Justice Works. Here's Desiree Hellegers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Is there a habitat in heaven for the species who no longer dwell on earth? When I book a trip on that old gospel ship, I would like to think the dodo has a berth. We have cut down the wildwood, the sweet water's blessed. It must be the eighth deadly sin to tear up creation so the birds have no nest. I only hope that God will take them in. I would like to take a walk with the great devil. I would like to see the passenger pigeons fly, and all the feathered folk who have no home in this world. I hope they find a home in the sky.
That was the late, great Yvonne Simmons and the very much still alive and kicking Mary Rose of the Portland duo Simmons-Rose. And that was Home in the Sky by Nancy Schimmel. And you're listening to the second half of a two-part memorial for peace activist Yvonne Simmons, who died in July after a nearly decades-long struggle with dementia. We'll be sure to repost the first half of the show along with this segment on the KBOO website. In that segment, we talked about Yvonne growing up against the backdrop of bombed-out buildings in post-World War II London. Yvonne ran away from home at the age of 13, fleeing sexual abuse, and she landed for a time on the streets of London, finding protection with slightly older Ban the Bomb, proto-punk street kids who helped shape Yvonne's politics. Before she even turned 18, Yvonne was forced to flee violence and sexual exploitation in London, and she often said that it was in running for her life that she found her life. Yvonne would go on to become a folk singer and to organize internationally against war and violence against women. In the 1990s, Yvonne repeatedly risked her life to bring aid to women and children during the siege of Sarajevo. For this work, at some point in the mid-90s, Yvonne was honored by the Oregonian, which named her Woman of the Year. Yvonne suffered a head injury being medevaced from Sarajevo and had to learn to walk and talk again. Yvonne's work was firmly grounded in anti-racist principles, and wherever she went, she took her lead from grassroots organizations and NGOs working on the ground. Alongside her work with humans, Yvonne also worked locally and internationally doing animal rescue. In this segment, we hear excerpts from the memorial service that was held for Yvonne in September. We hear more excerpts of songs by Simmons-Rose, and I talk also with Yvonne's longtime musical collaborator, Mary Rose. Here's Darian DeLue, U.S. President of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, or WILF, speaking at Yvonne's memorial service. Yvonne spent four decades organizing with WILF in Portland, nationally, and globally. Here's Darian DeLue.
WILF U.S. has benefited over the decades from Yvonne's input. I first became aware of her through the music she did with Mary Rose, which was very much consistent with what WILF US works for. WILF US is part of the international organization of Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. We have WILF groups in approximately 40 countries around the world, partly because the global situation to some extent is driven by U.S. government action, so we have a lot of things to pay attention to in the United States. We work on disarmament and ending war, earth democracy, which is to say climate catastrophe, fair and safe food, and other in the Middle East and the politics there, pushing for a nuclear free zone in the Middle East, among other things. We have a focus on some of the countries of Latin America. We have a program for women, money, and democracy to address corporate control and reclaim economic power. And we now have a new an issue committee working on domestic prisoners of war, which is to say domestic violence of all kinds. I had the pleasure of meeting Yvonne at one of our U.S. Congresses that take place every 3 years when the Clothesline Project was actually brought to the Congress itself to demonstrate for the members who were there how that worked. It became a nationwide initiative, and many cities in the U.S. undertook to have clothesline projects.
In the International Clothesline Project, women decorate t-shirts with messages that variously call out their abuse and affirm their own strength, dignity, and resilience.
I also was very impressed with her work in Sarajevo and the former Yugoslavia, where she gave us just terrifying descriptions of the way snipers in Sarajevo were picking off people seemingly at random in the city, and the resulting trauma for so many people, but particularly for women, many of whom were sexually assaulted. Finally, I am very enthusiastic about the power of songs and folk music to strengthen the political movements that many of us are so engaged in. Song can reach through to us on a different level, giving us empowered speech and emotional connection.
Dan Handelman co-hosted the memorial service, and together Dan and Yvonne were founding members of Portland Peace and Justice Works Portland Cop Watch. Here's Dan.
Thank you very much, Darian, for your memories of Yvonne. You know, WILF is one of the most amazing organizations. They've been around for over 100 years now, and I can't tell you how many times we at Peace and Justice Works have done work with WILF on anti-war actions and other related things. And your story about the Clothesline Project reminds me that the person who created the Clothesline Project out in Massachusetts came out here one day, and Yvonne displayed that the clothesline in a park downtown and did another program for Flying Focus about that.
Here's Yvonne's lifelong friend, Jan Burrell, who spoke from England during the virtual service.
I knew Yvonne since we were 16 and 17, and I was with her. We were the post-war children of the 60s and 70s, looking for adventure. Everything was Beatle, Maniac, Carnaby Street. There's lots going on, and it was a lovely time to be alive. We'd had so many adventures. She looked after me like a big sister. It would take weeks to tell of all our adventures that we got up to. Her great sense of humour, her love of life, especially children and animals. She did so much aid work and came to England on her way to Yugoslavia many times with trying to get the container lorries over the channel. I don't know how she managed to do it. It was amazing. Yvonne loved life. She was eternally young, and Yvonne used to bring joy everywhere she went. We were just ordinary kids from London, and we went out and we saw the world. That was our university.
Thank you very much. And you talked a little bit about the shipping containers that went through to Yugoslavia, and it hasn't happened. The next thing we're going to see is a clip from one of the several shows that Yvonne did about her trips to Yugoslavia.
The only inhabitants of Visegrad are Serb, but the Muslim-led government won the elections, but they're not represented there. It just doesn't make sense. Hmm. And this is happening in many other places. And they call it integration, I think. Well, I don't think that the Dayton Peace Accord can be implemented anyway. But we were talking about children, so let's go back there some better.
Yeah.
So I was saying that we had all these parties. I worked in a drop-in center. I just dropped in one day and said, can I come and help? And it was just a little, like a shop front, and they hardly had anything in there. And
did you learn how to sing the songs in Serbo Croatian?
Ja sam jedna vidrum vodi, plivam okolo, hebam čiči, balon čiči, plivam okolo. Ja sam jedna vidrum vodi, plivam okolo, hebam čiči, balon čiči, plivam okolo. I'm an actor in the waters when men around. Managed to get together a group of Bosnians that want to help the animals. We do have a registered organization of 70 people and international help from Animal Rescue Group. They give each other support all the time, and they laugh. They always have to have laughter. I mean, this is why they call me Jokolo. And they always have laughter in there. Because what they've had to face, what most people in that region has had to face is, it's nothing to that you can really laugh at, but it's like you have to because it's healthy.
So we have another clip coming up. So one of the groups that Yvonne worked with is called Women in Black, and it's really not a group, it's really more of a movement that is global. And one of its main focuses is the people of Palestine and the Israeli occupation there and the women who are under occupation. But they are supportive of women who are oppressed worldwide, and they wear black and hold usually silent vigils all over the place. Yvonne ran a version here where she was happy to talk throughout the entire time because that was Yvonne. There were no rules, so she made up her own rules. But so, yeah, many, many years she ran a Women in Black vigil in downtown Portland with a couple other folks, and they were there, you know, every week that Yvonne was available, she was down there. So the next clip is from a report back that she did in Portland about an international conference in Italy of the Women in Black movement.
Oh, it was incredible. There were women from about 21 countries. Women in Black is, for people who don't know, it's a network of women against war and against violence against women. And there were people from Palestine, Israel, Serbia, Bosnia, Croatia, America, England, Germany, all over Africa. We did a lot of actions too, which was really nice.
The highlights for me were meeting the women, being with the women, and we would sing at night, we'd sing in all different languages, and hearing what women were doing. It's so strengthening, and to know that it's by having, you know, being in this solidarity that we're going to find the strength to continue on and to change things. One of the things that the Italian women decided to do was this, which is called decontamination of words. And there were many words like the butterfly landmines. And so they say butterflies fly, not they don't explode. And the action we did with 400 women in black, with all their banners, of which one of the banners we all wrote in our own language, Women in Black, which was a very long banner. And then they were put down on the floor in a spiral. And a woman would read one of the things that were written here, and everybody, the 400 women, would echo. It was incredible.
Here's an excerpt of Simmons Rose singing the song Cassandra by Ann Lister. The song metaphorically links the Trojan prophetess Cassandra, who's dismissed as a madwoman when she predicts the Trojan War, and the thousands of women who risked arrest to protest the sighting of cruise nuclear missiles at Grenham Commons RAF base in England. The women's peace encampment at Grenham Commons began in September 1981 with women chaining themselves against the base fence, and the encampment lasted for nearly 20 years until 2000. The beautiful woman referenced in the song is Helen of Troy, who becomes a metaphor for the glorification of war.
And the war went on then for years, on land and over the water, and all of the deaths and the tears of all of our sons and daughters. How beautiful she was, and yet when I think of her face, I think of the smell of blood and all of the ruin and disgrace. And only Cassandra saw, for she had the gift of the gods to tell the truth of the future, the poison edge of the gods, and nobody would believe her. How beautiful to see clear, and yet when you see all the pain, to shout and no one to hear, to watch it all happen again. And only Cassandra saw. You may think this is all in the past, you may think that this is all finished, but just look aside and across, and none of the pain is diminished. How beautiful are they, all our sisters and daughters and friends, sitting across all the roads, cutting through the security fence.
not only Cassandra now. There's a wooden horse they call Cruz that present from our friends and allies, and those weapons they've built them to use. If you believe the excuses and lies, how beautiful are they, all our mothers and daughters and wives, to stand in front of the soldiers, guarding our futures and lives, just like Cassandra.
This past week, I spoke with Mary Rose, the other half of the folk duo Simmons Rose, and we talked about the performances they gave at movement events amid the sustained pressure to shut down the Trojan nuclear plant outside Rainier, Oregon. Following nearly two decades of organized resistance, the plant was shut down in 1993 and imploded in 2006. Here's Mary Rose.
Yvonne was very much concerned about the nuclear situation, and as members of Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, we joined together with that. And the first time we sang together was downtown at Pioneer Courthouse Square. There was an anti-Rainier nuclear power plant gathering, and Yvonne had made up new words to "This Little Light of Mine" and sang that, and I thought that was wonderful that she did that, because those old songs that we know, I think, always can use a few new words for some occasion like that. And she would always be ready to sing whenever we found or heard of something that we wanted to protest against or volunteer our services, which were singing and playing. We were eager to do that, and that was wonderful for me because her voice was strong and she had no fear in front of an audience.
I remember you said that I think that the largest venue possibly that you ever sang at was Helen Caldicott was speaking. Is that right?
Oh, yes. Helen Caldicott was here in Portland. Again, the anti-nuclear event. And there were many, many people out in front. And it was wonderful because we just sang very freely. And it was freeing experience. It was probably the most people that we ever sang in front of that I remember. We sang for lots of small groups, but it was usually to do with Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. We sang that B-side, which is on the recording that I hope people will listen to, that there's something I always wanted to say to you men. How would you like to hear this again and again? Watch out, beware, take care, be careful, whatever you do.
To hear Simmons Rose sing Peggy Seeger's B-side, check out the first half of this two-part segment. When I spoke with her this past week, Mary Rose remembered a little snippet of a song that the two of them used to sing together at anti-nuke events. Here's Mary Rose.
You can make steam with a boiler or by the light of the sun, but making steam with a nuclear plant is like killing a fly with a gun. Killing a fly with a gun. And if the gun gets hot and the shooter gets shot, there's nothing you can do about it.
That was Mary Rose of the Portland folk duo Simmons Rose. You've been listening to a memorial segment about the life and times of Yvonne Simmons, a teenage runaway and London street kid who went on to become a folk singer and an international peace activist and a founding member of Portland Peace and Justice Works Portland Cop Watch. This is a two-part segment, so we'll be posting the first part when we post the show. Mary Rose has generously agreed to make their album Listen to the Women Again available digitally to anyone who's interested. If you'd like a digital copy, email me at desiree.helligers@wsu.edu, as in Washington State University.edu. WSU Vancouver's Collective for Social and Environmental Justice will soon be the digital home also of an archive documenting Yvonne's life and work. This has been Desiree Helligers for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and we're going to play out with Simmons Rose doing Bernice Johnson Reagan's Ella Song. A tribute to civil rights organizer Ella Baker. Rest in power, Yvonne.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes.
Until the killing of black men, black mothers, sons, is as important as the killing of white men, white mother sons.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes.
That which touches me most is that I had a chance to work with people,
passing on to others that which was passed on to me.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes.
To me, young people come first. They have the courage where we fail.
If I could but shed some light as they carry us through the gale.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest. Some cannot rest.
The older I get, the better I know that the secret of my going on
is when the reins are in the hands of the young who dare to run against the storm.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes.
Not needing to clutch for power,
not needing the light just to shine on me.
I need to be one in the number as we stand against tyranny.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes.
Struggling myself don't mean a whole lot, I've come to realize.
But teaching others to stand for their rights is the only way our struggle survives.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes.
I'm a woman who speaks with a voice, and I must be heard.
Sometimes I can be quite difficult, I bow to no man's words.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes.
That was Ella's song, sung by Simmons Rose, following Desiree Helliger's for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Finally, this episode, Fran Michel recommends the novel Confessions of the Fox, a genre-bending work of radical, speculative history from below, by Jordy Rosenberg. Here's Fran Michel for the Old Mall Variety Hour.
Good morning. This is Fran Michel, here to tell you about Confessions of the Fox, an acclaimed genre-bending 2018 novel by Jordy Rosenberg, available through the Multnomah County Library, as well as through bookstores and bootlegs. Although Rosenberg deserves all the rewards possible for his accomplished fiction, pirate version might even be appropriate. Confessions of the Fox features a renegade manuscript of dubious provenance and authenticity, and the disaffected academic who finds it, edits it, steals it, and protects its secrets. The manuscript, dated 1724, appears to be the memoirs of Jack Shepherd, the real historical figure who helped inspire John Gay's Beggar's Opera and Bertolt Brecht's Threepenny Opera. Shepherd was a pickpocket, thief, jailbreaker, and folk hero. As the novel describes him, quote, "Jack is a compact mutt with an intuition for all possible points of entry, opening, and release. Whether of jails or of women, there has never been a locked door, window, or wall that he could not gentle open into an ecstasy of trespass. Jack is a creature of liberation." End quote. In this fictional memoir, Shepherd was also, like his 21st century editor, Dr. R. Voth, assigned female at birth. Voth finds the manuscript at a book sale, where the university library is selling off three floors of books as part of remodeling to make room for dean's offices and a dining atrium for upper-level administrators. The 21st century frame tale, which appears in the editor's foreword and in copious discursive footnotes, offers a good deal of such academic satire. Dr. Voth is put on unpaid leave, for instance, after the dean of surveillance catches him playing Scrabble on his phone during office hours. When the university allies with a private company hoping to monetize discoveries in the manuscript, Voth absconds with it to keep its secrets out of the marketplace. The bureaucratic capitalism and carceral apparatus that Dr. Voth encounters in the present has its roots in the 18th century in which the memoir is set, and the novel highlights the need for a usable past and an imaginative archive. As one reviewer notes of events in the memoir, quote, "When the English government warns citizens against plague, they charge that the disease is coming from South Asians. London's government requires that the dirtiest and poorest parts of the city be contained, explaining that the poor, foreign-born, or persons of color are more apt to spread disease. The use of fear tactics to enforce rule via discrimination echoes government's articulation of immigration policy today. The quarantine also recalls the panic that arose over HIV and AIDS in the 80s and 90s." End quote. In both history and fiction, Jack's popularity comes in part from his evasion of forms of control, both crude and familiar, his liberation from the traps of waged labor and oppressive law. Jack's first escape is from the carpenter to whom he is apprenticed, who chains him to his bed at night. His first jailbreak, however, includes his lover Bess, a South Asian sex worker. Bess and her jailbreak are historically attested, though the conventional archive is silent on her race. In Confessions of the Fox, her father was a Lascar sailor who jumped ship and escaped from the East India Company to the Fens. The Fenlands were an area of marshland that supported hunting and fishing communities until, in a major engineering project using prison labor, they were drained for agricultural use. Bess's parents are radical Quakers and are among those who fought against this project of enclosure and destruction of wetlands, the Fen Tigers. That the conflicts over draining the Fens occurred mostly a century earlier than the events of the memoir take place is one of the few historical liberties that Rosenberg takes. For the most part, the novel's inventions explore the unmentioned, like the possibilities of Bess's racial position or why Jack Shepherd was so often described as small or slight or otherwise effeminate. In the author's acknowledgments that follow the narrative, Rosenberg notes that the novel is, quote, "a fiction crafted in fidelity to the London we know was true, a diasporic London, shaped through centuries of Black and South Asian communities and labor. But of course, this fiction is itself necessarily partial and fallible." End quote. That fallibility is also explored as Confessions of the Fox unfolds, and Voth gathers evidence of later interpolations and a kind of collective authorship for the manuscript. This is radical speculative history from below, attentive, as Rosenberg acknowledges, to histories of mass incarceration, racialization, colonialism, the cruelties of capitalism, the militarization of the police, and the inextricability of embodied life and struggle from that history. But the novel also attends gloriously to the joys and promise of that struggle. As he leaves the university with the manuscript, Dr. Voth is crying. Not for sadness, he says. No, quote, "I cry when I see a flash, if only briefly, that something other and better than this world already exists in potentia. It doesn't have to be profound. I cry the same set of tears when team members throw themselves in each other's arms after winning a game as I do when we lock arms in front of the police." End quote. That better world is not yet here. but there's joy in spending time with a book that glimpses it when we lock arms in front of the police. I'll leave you with one more comment from Dr. Voth. Quote, "The body has two histories." So says the manuscript. There is the history that binds us all, the terrible history that began when the police first swarmed the streets of the cities and the settlers streamed down the decks of their ships, casting shadows on the world to turn themselves white, casting the wickedest net. There is no trans body, no body at all, no memoir, no confessions, no singular story of you or anyone outside this broad and awful legacy. So when they ask for our story, when they want to sell it, we don't let them forget. Slavery, surveillors, settlers, and their shadows. But the second history of the body, the second history is love's inscription. End quote. For the Old Mill Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michel, recommending the novel Confessions of the Fox by Jordy Rosenberg.
This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour for December 5th, 2022. I'm John Nelson. Thanks to Fran Michel, Desiree Helligers, and Bill Resnick, and to their guests Kenzo Esquivel, Mary Rose, Dan Handelman, and Darian DeLue. You can find this episode alongside other archived episodes of The Old Mole in Time at kboo.fm. Just search for The Old Mole Variety Hour. Suggestions, comments, or questions can be sent from the webpage there or to oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com.